The Strikers knew their story had the power to move people emotionally. While Mary Heaton Vorse was writing the Textile Workers' Bulletin, Strikers commissioned a film to spread the word, silently. It was called The Passaic Textile Strike. The movie still exists. Professional filmmakers began the project, but it was completed by a radical group who later would form the Film and Photo League, which made propaganda films in the 30s. The film ended up half melodrama, half documentary. It contains graphic footage of the police beating up the strikers. In the fictionalized segments, the boss is portrayed not only as a miser, but a lecher. Documentary film historian Steve Krinsky.
What's interesting about the film they made is that it was really an attempt to kind of harness the power of silent movies, which in the early days of the 20th century was the most powerful medium imaginable to people at the time. That was the era of movie palaces and the big Hollywood productions. And people on the left, particularly in Europe, recognized that that power was something important to be part of. And in a sense, the American left came to this very late. The Europeans, particularly the Russians and the Germans, almost immediately, certainly right after the Russian Revolution, people like Eisenstein and many others did some incredibly creative things with cinema as part of the social movements of their time and place.
The Passaic Textile Strike film reached audiences from the East Coast to the Midwest, mainly industrial cities and towns, according to Steve Krinsky.
The film was shown 6 times in 2 days in Haverhill, Massachusetts, a shoe production town, running alongside 2 comedies and a newsreel. It was often shown alongside Russian films brought over from the revolutionary country. According to news reports in Haverhill, workers of this city packed the Lafayette Theater last night. In Boston, blocks of tickets were bought by the Jewish Bakers Union, the Photo Engravers Union, the Bill Posters Union, and locals of carpenters, painters, and engineers. In New York City, it was shown at the New Waldorf Theater, continuous performances from 2 to 11. The ad for the screening notes that, quote, the picture of the Passaic Strike will be played to the tune of the famous Russian Balalaika Orchestra. And at the bottom of the page, it said, no worker can afford to miss this picture. I don't have any doubt that anybody seeing this film in the right context would not be moved by it, particularly since the standard method for showing films like this was to have it travel with a speaker. The response was very positive.
Despite the growing national support for the strikers, the management of the mills showed no sign of relenting on the wage cut. In March 1926, a committee of strikers went to Washington to seek a congressional investigation of the conditions in Passaic. Strike publicist Mary Heaton Vorse was a member of that delegation. Again, historian D. Garrison.
She went there along with others to appeal to senators and congressmen in Washington. And in particular, Senator La Follette was a person who eventually came out in support of the strike, along with many, many other middle-class politicians. She was a little too aggressive in her approach to these politicians. She didn't know how to say it in such a way so it didn't, you know, she wanted to say, Senator Follett, you know, get off your butt and do something now. And this was not the way you address senators. And so they didn't let her go back very much.
The strikers' delegation attempted to see President Calvin Coolidge. When they reached the White House, the president's secretary told them to take their case to the Department of Labor. Albert Weisbord later said he could not understand how the president could be too busy to meet with them when, in his words, he had time for Charleston dancers, glee club singers, and all sorts of other people who had no particular business to transact. In fact, Coolidge wasn't too busy. He and other conservatives were sympathetic to the mill owners and suspicious of the strike leadership. Historian D. Garrison.
The only way that the conservatives could make these people look okay was to call the leaders of the strike communist. And, of course, Vorse was accused of being a communist. Albert Weisbord, who led the strike, was a communist. Voris was not. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn really wasn't at that point either. I mean, that's a whole other story about the history of the Communist Party, but that's the way they hit Voris, and that's the way they hit the leaders, and that's what the conservatives said over and over. These workers are fine. They're not worried about anything. It's the agitating communists who want to overthrow our democracy, etc. It was the classical old Red Scare approach that has been used so often in American history to fight the left or liberals.
To counter the accusation that this first communist-led strike in America was a foreign threat, Moscow trying to take over the city of Passaic, Weisbord countered with what he called the German question.
The mill owners were not Americans, but Germans, some of them enemy aliens whose property had been sequestered by the U.S. government and was in the custody of Colonel Johnson. I decided to ignore the colonel and to attack the real owners. Many of the strikers were returned soldiers. To the clubs and bombs of the police, the strikers had answered with the wearing of their steel trench helmets and gas masks. They had fought the Kaiser in Germany, and they were going to fight the Kaisers of America.
Albert Weisbord deflected anti-communism with patriotism. But there was also the question of anti-Semitism. He was a Jew in a town of Catholic workers. But he turned this to his advantage as well.
By openly matching myself with Abe Preskill, Jewish commissioner of public safety in charge of the police, actually headed by the German Chief Zober, I openly called Preskill to task for violating the Jewish tradition by being part of a police military force and of behaving against the interests of the people in the country where Jews immigrated. Not Preskill, but I was the best example of the Jew in his relation to the general population. The strikers met my attack on the Jew Preskill with whoops of joy and merriment. The Jewish issue was settled. No one talked of the protocols of Zion. The Catholic churches became friendly. The Jewish middle class in Passaic came to support the strike. The religious issue no longer could be brought up.
Failing to discredit Albert Weisbord, the mill owners and their allies decided to lock him up. On April 10, 1926, Passaic police descended on the United Front headquarters, arresting Weisbord and other strike leaders.
In the evening following the arrests, those of us left of the staff, a few women, went into New York to obtain whatever counsel and help we could at the party headquarters. I was unable to sleep at all that night, imagining Albert attacked and beaten in jail. A few days later, I went out to see him in the county jail at Paterson. He had on a sort of striped pajama suit, looked pale and heroic.
Then, with the strike leaders in jail, Sheriff Morgan was called into the city of Passaic. He immediately armed his deputies and started to see to it that there were no mass picket lines in Passaic. At the same time, Sheriff Nimmo was called into Garfield by Mayor Botany Burke. With the utmost brazenness, the mill owners furnished Nimmo with deputies, and in defiance of the law, even paid them out of their own pockets in order to be sure to secure immediate control of them. At once, Nimmo closed down the only meeting place of the strikers in Garfield, read the riot act, proclaimed riot law. What that was, no one knew except the sheriff, and he said it was something like martial law. No meeting or groupings of any kind were permitted. And broke up all picket lines, arrested many prominent New York liberals who had come to defend the civil liberties of the strikers. A real reign of terror was started.
2 days after Weisbord was arrested, police dispersed a crowd of 5,000 strikers at the Forstmann and Huffman Mill in Garfield. 7 people were arrested, including Robert N. Dunn, director of the American Civil Liberties Union. Weisbord.
To cap it all, the Forstmann-Huffman Company secured the most drastic temporary restraining order in New Jersey legal history. No one could picket or even talk about the strike or contribute any money to it. Ordinarily, to left-wing leadership, injunctions are mere scraps of paper. This injunction, however, was enforced by 700 armed men, ready to shoot to kill.
Now the issue became one of freedom of speech and assembly. Like another cause célèbre of the period, the Sacco and Vanzetti case, the Passaic strike created a coalition of liberals, communists, and socialists.
Norman Thomas was in a big feud with the communists.
Martha Stone Asher.
They spoke at different meetings and had debated all the questions that came from the textbooks of Karl Marx and Nikolai Lenin. And he was an ardent opponent, you know, active opponent. He announced to the communists that he was going into the strike. And he didn't want any hassle. He wanted to speak to the people. He wanted to support his members in the Socialist Party, wanted to help out. And they didn't want to be ostracized. And they weren't. That was one time when the communists yielded. In those years, the struggles were pretty bitter. But in this case, he was honored, he spoke, and the only opposition came from the police who arrested him.
In fact, Norman Thomas got arrested on purpose, an act of civil disobedience, an attempt to overturn the Riot Act as an unconstitutional restriction on all public demonstrations. Thomas, who had inherited the leadership of the Socialist Party from Eugene Debs, was freed on $10,000 bail. Weisbord was released when he posted $25,000.
Public reaction to these fresh outrages was intense.
Vera Bush.
We had publicized the extremely low wages, the new wage cuts inflicted, the long hours, the speed-up, the night work of women, illegal at that time in New Jersey, the high death rate of babies and young children in the mill towns, the illiteracy of the workers, and the employers' resistance to efforts of the Board of Education to teach the workers English. In the wake of public indignation, some of the more decent men on the Passaic police force, disgusted with what they were called upon to do, resigned, their places being filled by thugs picked up from the Bowery of New York. The strike had become a scandal.
The suppression of the Passaic wool workers may have united liberals, socialists, and communists, but it did not bring together the divided labor movement. The American Federation of Labor, wary of immigrants, threatened by industrial unionism, workers organized by industry rather than by skilled craft, wanted nothing to do with this communist-led strike. Again, Vera Bush.
Now, to add to our difficulties, the AFL leadership, which so far had followed a hands-off, no-help policy toward our strike, came out openly against it.
On July 1, 1926, 9 months into the walkout, AFL President William Green denounced the strike leaders as communists, bent on destroying the AFL by setting up a competing dual union. The Communist Party, always ambivalent about Weisbord's independent ways, offered an accommodation and told Weisbord to go along.
Out of jail, I was informed by the leading party comrades that there was a fair chance the strike could be settled if we entered the American Federation of Labor. An appointment was made for me to see Sidney Hillman, president of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union of America, who, with the interested concern of Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, might serve as an intermediary. At our meeting held in his office, Hillman asked how I felt on joining the AFL and the indispensability of my leadership. I answered warily that the United Front Committee had come to Passaic not as a dual union, because there had been no other union in the field to be dual to, and not as an inflexible opponent of the AFL. If our joining the AFL would settle the strike in a favorable manner and permit the functioning of a strong democratic union, I was all for our joining. As for me, my decision coincided with the needs of the workers, and I would not stand in the way of a favorable settlement.
Though he fought the decision, Weisbord did what the party told him to do, hand over the strike to the AFL. On August 13, 1926, in the 10th month of the strike, Albert Weisbord stepped aside as leader of the Passaic wool workers. Later, he came to believe there was a conspiracy between the AFL and the Communist Party to destroy his militant, independent union. But it might have been more confusion than conspiracy, according to Brown University historian Paul Buell.
The complications of the national leadership of the Communist Party, and on the one hand, and the local leadership of individual communists in Passaic, is very difficult to fathom because we only have it from one side, more or less, from the side of Albert Weisbord. They may have been jealous of Weisbord's rising popularity and charisma as threats to themselves, but it seems just as likely that they were terrified by the prospect of needing to conduct a major strike without anything close to the kinds of material resources and human resources to put into the cause.
I did not know, and the strikers did not know, that I was to be removed permanently and not allowed to come back. It was also made sure that when I did come back, there was nothing to come back to. At a big union rally, I bade my departure. But the strikers waited for weeks before the AFL United Textile Workers came into the picture. I was sent away on a several months national speaking tour.
Now the mill owners revealed what they really had in mind. On August 19th, Charles F.H. Johnson, vice president of Botany Worsted Mill, announced to his employees gathered in the mill yard that the company would have nothing to do with the new union sponsored by the American Federation of Labor, claiming to represent those no longer employed at the mills. In other words, the strikers. On August 20th, Julius Forstman, president of the Forstman-Huffman Company, told his employees he would deal with them only through the representative assembly. In other words, the company union.
Soon the strike had fizzled out to a mere caricature of what it was.
Again, the leader of the Passaic Woolworkers' strike, Albert Weisbord.
The UTW officials all met secretly with the mill owners. No workers had anything to say about the so-called negotiations, which dragged on interminably. There was no recognition of the union. Those returning were discriminated against and refused employment. In 1 year's time, this splendid body of strikers was reduced to a mere caucus. This was the victory that the CP leaders had foreseen and hailed. I yielded to fight another day. I had not heard from Russia. I knew that Russia had denounced the leadership of the party for failing to play any role whatsoever in this great strike.
And now it was all over. The great meetings, the parades, the eloquent speeches, the cheers and singing, the terror, the turmoil, the constant daily effort, the travail and the glory of our strike, all gone. The headquarters returned to the subdued quiet that had preceded the strike. Our small staff would gather forlornly for consultation and mutual commiseration. We were all tired, and some were ill.
At the end of the year, there was not even a union to come back to. All was dead in textile unionism in Passaic.
Everybody was exhausted. They couldn't see themselves going on. Hunger was a big question already. Relief was beginning to decline a bit, although they raised plenty of money all along. But, you know, it was so long, and with both men and women working, there was no source of any other income. And so people said, look, you can't win. They regretted that Weisbord was gone. They kept saying maybe we would have had a better settlement if he was there in the negotiations, but they gave support to the people who were there. I went home.
Unlike the young volunteers or the well-heeled supporters who came and went in their shiny sedans from New York City, the wool workers had nowhere to go. They were home. They had endured a strike of 11 months, 16,000 of them, and the mills had not recognized their union. The first major strike organized by the American Communist Party did rescind the 10% wage cut, and it gave the workers a glimpse of what solidarity might bring if one could hold out forever. Albert Weisbord's vision of a powerful, independent, militant union roared for a moment in the 1920s and went silent. One lasting union did emerge from the strike. In 1928, Albert Weisbord married Vera Bush. A year later, they both were involved in the strike of the cotton textile workers in Gastonia, North Carolina, another militant walkout in which the Communist Party leadership disappointed them. Weisbord and Bush left the party in 1929.
Albert Weisbord was far too mercurial to remain in any organization that he did not lead.
Paul Buell.
And he would have been expelled as a follower of Leon Trotsky if he hadn't left of his own accord. Thereafter, he led or took part in several further splits within the Trotskyist wing of the American left, and ended up in a small Chicago office by himself. It said only two or three people ever came into that office. He was waiting for the revolution to come to him.
In 1956, the Botany Wool Mill in Passaic, New Jersey, shut down. Albert Weisbord died at age 77 in 1977. His wife, Vera Bush Weisbord, died 10 years later.
They're closing down the textile mill across the railroad tracks. Foreman says these jobs are going, boys, and they ain't coming back.
If you said to me, what were the ultimate consequence of the 1926 strike?
Jim Shenton.
Let's be blunt. They lost. Nothing had changed. If anything, it had gotten worse. If I were to summarize it in a single word, I would say, if you lived in Passaic and were working class, bleak. Totally, absolutely bleak. This is not an inspiring story.
Passaic on Strike was a co-production of NJN Public Radio and the New Jersey Historical Commission. It was written and produced by David S. Cohen and Marty Goldenson. Phil Bosco played Albert Weisbord. Allison Fraser played Vera Bush. Charles Potter, John Dos Passos. Jane Sharp played Mary Heaton Vorse. Martha Stone Asher, who was 16 when she volunteered at the strike, played herself. Leszek Wojcik was the recording engineer. Special effects, David Rapkin. Graphics, Deborah Thomas. The executive producer was Bill Jobes. Thanks also to the Botto House American Labor Museum, the Passaic Public Library, and Mark Auerbach. Funding for this program came from the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, a state partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities and the New Jersey Historical Commission.
They're closing down textile mill across the railroad tracks.
One final note. Shortly after this documentary was completed, Martha Stone Asher died.
They arrested all the bread.
She was 95.
And it became a big issue among the strikers until the bread was freed. That's how they talked about it.
I'm Marty Goldenson.